I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Health Today with the University of Maryland Medical Center's Center for Advanced Fetal Care. We continue our conversation with Dr. Chris Harmon about the uniqueness and history of the Center for Advanced Fetal Care's work.
The CAFCA, as we call it, started in a single room with ultrasound appointments on 2 half-days a week. Now we have 8 ultrasound rooms. We're packed every day. So it's a great time to be practicing fetal medicine, and the hospital has recognized that by this fabulous facility. So some of the orientation of the CAFCA is also recognition of this isn't an X-ray lab. So you don't see these winding floors and the feng shui colors and that sort of thing in an X-ray lab. We have a few ancillary rooms for blood sampling and so on, because a lot of times the mothers... biochemistry can tell us a lot of things that are going on. Now, this is our one of our sort of typical rooms. They're large in case we have to do procedures, but they're mostly large because lots of times there's 4 or 5 family members, so we have sort of the viewing screen for the family and the patient.
That means they can see a sonogram.
That's right. They can see the full sonogram
right.
Up overhead. All of these rooms are equipped with equipment, needles, solutions, and so on to do procedures.
What you're describing here and what I've been reading about advanced fetal care is this incredible new world of fetal intervention, whether it's blood sampling or different kind of surgeries you can do on the fetus. I mean, the advances we've made in helping a fetus survive full term to become a child. I mean, pretty amazing. Maybe we could just talk a bit about what some of those great advances have been and what you've done here that has kind of revolutionized the field.
The progression of fetal therapy has dealt with more and more dangerous things. So what's happened now in our pioneering efforts here have been to understand and to avoid having to do all this stuff. So some of the techniques that have been adopted, initiated here, generated by our group, and now spread around the world, are non-invasive things that clarify the situation instead of prompting an invasive management. Another thing that we pioneered was the insertion of tiny catheters, little plastic tubes, into the baby's bladder. Sometimes the bladder is obstructed, and after a while, the baby can't pee at all, the fetus. And so both the kidneys and the lungs are ruined by this disease. It turns out that we can put a tiny plastic catheter down the center of a large needle into the bladder, and with ultrasound guidance, make sure that one end is in the bladder and the other end is in the amniotic fluid space, which both drains the bladder and fills up the amniotic cavity. Those are babies who would otherwise die, whose lives can be saved, and who, a thing that we're really excited about, is so specialized that it's actually only being done in 3 centers around the country, is a thing called the MOMS trial. That stands for the Management of Myomeningocele Before Birth. And so that's done, again, with this little telescope that helps us see what we're doing, and then specialized instruments are passed down which actually can sew closed the hole created by spina bifida.
Maryland must be, I mean, how many places do what we're doing here at Maryland?
Not many.
I think when you look at the combination of things that we do and who does it, so the combination of invasive things, invasive procedures, obstetricians trained in fetal medicine, sonographers trained in fetal physiology, we're unique. And I think that's why the hospital has recognized this by spending almost $5 million of giving us easily the best, most beautiful, most well-equipped fetal assessment unit in the country.
For more information about the Center for Advanced Fetal Care at the University of Maryland Medical Center, please call 410-328-3865 or log on to www.marylandfetalcare.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. Good afternoon.
And we're here to have interesting conversations over the course of these next couple hours. This originally started out because I read an article by a man who's been on the show numerous times, Sam Faddis, who's a former leading CIA operations officer, has written the book Willful Neglect, The Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security. He wrote an op-ed on May the 6th, Al-Qaeda's nuclear plant. When he said we are looking at the wrong thing here, and we're going to ask him to describe that in a moment and talk about how that might really be affecting, and then talk about how that might really be affecting foreign policy and what we should be thinking about in a larger sense when it comes to Pakistan and Afghanistan, because we are knee-deep in it. The question is what to do about it. We're also joined this hour by Phyllis Menes, who is author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and she's director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Frank Gaffney is founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under the Reagan administration. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us, and all of you back again.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Good to have you, Phyllis. And Sam, you there?
I am. Thank you for having me on.
Frank Gaffney, you with us too?
Frank?
Okay. Frank is not here, but he'll be here in a minute. let me ask you first, Sam Faddis, to kind of describe for our listeners who may not be New York Times readers, so many are not.
I'm sure many are.
just what you're positing here in terms of what we're missing in our national security strategy.
Well, the specific piece that you were talking about, Mark, that I wrote that was in the Times was talk about this gentleman named Sharif Mobley, who was actually a U.S. citizen that grew up in New Jersey, left for Yemen a couple of years ago, ostensibly to study Islam and Arabic, ended up being detained earlier this year in a security sweep by Yemeni forces, along with a number of other al-Qaeda members. In other words, it was a raid on an al-Qaeda site, safe site, taken into custody. This guy, before he left the country, actually spent about 5 years off and on working in nuclear power plants in the United States. So I recall six different plants around the Mid-Atlantic, including Calvert Cliffs right here in Maryland. And the point of the article was to point out that while we're all focused on this Times Square thing, that we've got much, much bigger fish to fry, to use a really tired old analogy. That, you know, this is a guy who, even though he's back in the hands of security forces now, by this point we have to presume has passed along all of the information he would have gained from working inside these power plants to al-Qaeda, who's had a long interest in this thing. And we ought to be very worried about that. Of course, that's all against the backdrop of the fact that nuclear power plant security is really not adequate to begin with.
Now, I wonder, Phyllis, when you... I assume you probably saw Sam Faddis's op-ed piece in the mm-hmm. Times. And when you look at our foreign policy, I'm curious how you think these issues, these national security issues, affect what our foreign policy should be. I mean, you are a strong and cogent advocate for getting out of Afghanistan and changing the way our nature of our foreign policy. But how do those two things interplay for you?
Well, I think there's no question that our foreign policy gives rise to many of our foreign policy threats. The two are integrally related, and I think that we ignore that or deny that at our peril. It's not to say that we can simply get out of Afghanistan and everything will be fine. We need to, in my view, get our military out, and then begins a very long and complicated and costly process of engagement on an entirely different level. The same I've been saying for Iraq. So this is much more complicated. The people who used to say we can't just cut and run,
right?
They said it for different reasons. They said it for ideological reasons to justify a war. But the point of it is true. It's not about just getting out and coming home. This isn't about isolationism. But in my view, the enormous debt that we owe the people of Afghanistan, very much like the debt we owe the people of Iraq, after having so much intervention, so much involvement in those countries that has left those countries so devastated, I think that we have to be very clear that we owe an enormous debt and we can't begin to make good on it until we end our military engagement. then it goes to the question of, well, what's going to make us safer? Clearly, what we're doing in Afghanistan is not making us safer. To the contrary, we have more soldiers being killed. We have more attempted acts of terrorism against civilians. And the notion that somehow we're going to be able to kill our way into peace simply doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work, and it shouldn't work. The notion that it would, I don't know why anybody believes that. For every time we get it right on the basis of the particular person that an assassination team or more likely an unmanned drone is trying to go after, for every time that they get it right and kill the right person, 30 or 60 or 90 or 500 more are killed who are civilians, and then there's the families. And what do we think those families are going to think about us who are responsible for killing civilians, people in their village, people in their tribe, people in their community? So this notion that somehow we can somehow identify with notoriously bad intelligence, we can identify who are the, quote, right people to assassinate, as if we have the right to do that, as if that's somehow okay under either international law or U.S. law, which it certainly is not. But even if we did, the notion that we could somehow identify all the right people and kill them, and everybody else would be grateful to us, and that's what would keep us safe, simply boggles the imagination. It's sort of the opposite of the real world.
I'm very curious. This is Anthony McCarthy. I was listening to the words of our Justice Department and our Attorney General, and he was talking about the intelligence and the information that is being shared by Faisal Shahzad, and how he is very pleased at the level of specificity that they are getting from this young man who, as our listeners know, is being accused of being planning the devices in Times Square in the vehicle there. I'm very curious about this idea of Americans being radicalized late in their life as teenagers or young adults. Does it matter if they are radicalized inside this country and then they go be trained and become part of this terrorist movement against the United States? Or should that affect our policy? I know a great deal of information and questions are being raised about Al-Qaeda and other groups' ability to reach into this country and trigger some sort of empathy and anger and indignation towards this country by citizens in this country. Should that inform our policy at all, Sam?
I don't think I guess my point is, I don't think that Al-Qaeda is entering our country and convincing people. I think people in this country and elsewhere around the world are looking at our policies and they're angry. And for some tiny, luckily it's very tiny, percentage of those very large numbers of very angry people, some tiny percentage decides that they're going to respond with violence. And they then go, and then it's not hard to go find some half-baked training camp somewhere, obviously not a very good one, in terms of what they actually trained him to do. We were all very lucky. I was actually in Times Square that Saturday night. I'm quite glad that this was such an abject failure.
Mm-hmm.
But we were lucky. But this wasn't an instance of Al-Qaeda reaching into our country and radicalizing somebody somehow. This was somebody who grew up here, saw policies he didn't like, and took what I believe to be a criminal path, if this is the right person, and we still don't know that for sure, it seems it is, took a criminal path to respond rather than a different path. But the notion that this was somehow initiated by Al-Qaeda as if they are the starting point here, I think that's simply not the case. And if we ignore our own, the reasons that people turn against our government, against our people, this becomes very, very, very dangerous. If we don't look at the boogeyman term that we were told we couldn't use after 9/11, called root causes, we're going to fail to keep our country safe. Well, we're failing so far, and I think part of the problem is we don't look enough at root causes.
Frank Rathney has joined us, and Sam Faddis is with us. Frank, welcome. Good to have you with us once again. It's been a while.
Thank you.
So I'd like you to respond to what you just heard. I mean, and the question I think you heard Anthony pose.
Well, I didn't hear all of it, but I think I heard enough to say that I'm all for looking at root causes, too. But I think that for about 1,200 years before there was the United States, let alone one that had policies that people found offensive, there was something called Sharia that requires its adherents to engage in jihad for the purpose of destroying all other forms of government that stand in the way of its ultimate triumph worldwide. And I think this is sometimes called radicalism or radical. It's certainly radical to us who think that a democratic, free society that treats women with respect instead of as chattel is actually a radical thing. But I think the point is that the truth of the matter is we're people who are imbued with this sense that God deems them as the ones who will be supreme in the world, and all others will either convert or submit or die. And that's the root cause in virtually every single one of these attacks, and we ignore it at our extreme peril. And we try to actually say, oh no, it's really about our policies, I think, at our extreme peril as well.
But Phyllis, before ask you to jump back in, let me ask Sam to come in, but and then I do want you to come right back here, Phyllis. Sam Faddis, as someone who is a former CIA operative and someone who's been on the ground in Iraq and other places, I mean, you've heard this dialogue, and I'm curious what you think about the juxtaposition of these two ideas right now.
Well, one of the things I say just up front is I do think there is a valid point here from contending with this problem of focusing on the fact that we do have now a phenomenon. It's not an isolated incident; it's a whole series of events, and there's no reason to think that it's going to stop. Of individuals within the United States who are, to use a term, radicalizing. And in some cases, that's because they're in contact with people abroad. In some cases, I think it's probably something closer to self-radicalizing. And I don't want to get hung up on the use of that particular term. But it certainly is. This whole conflict evolves continuously. And we have been focused so much for such a long time on this idea that somehow we can sort of build barriers to keep people out and avoid a repetition of teams coming in from abroad. And I think we need to focus on the fact that, quite frankly, we, like many other countries, the United Kingdom's been doing this for years, are now faced with the fact that we're actually breeding our own terrorists, if you will, internally. More generally, I would say this. I think everybody who works counterterrorism, and I've worked it for many, many, many years, would absolutely say that the military and intelligence angles of winning this war, if that's the correct term, or resolving this conflict, are only pieces of what has to be done. And nobody who runs counterterrorism operations under any illusion that there aren't huge cultural, social, and economic dynamics here. And if we don't deal with this thing as a whole package, if we just look at this conflict as a matter of a head count, of like there's some finite number of individuals out there and we're supposed to track them all down and get rid of them and then we'll be done, if that's the approach we take, then we really don't have an idea what we're doing. It's a much more complex situation than that.
Well, one last thought, Sam, before I turn to Phyllis. I want to pose a very specific question to Phyllis and Frank and you, but I mean, as someone who did that, whose job it was to do that, so what are you suggesting now would be a policy that if you had the ear of the president as a former CIA officer, what would you be saying we should be doing instead then? Or are you saying that?
Well, look, I think there are, unfortunately, and I'm not trying to be cavalier because anything that has to do with loss of human life, regardless of whose it is, ought to be a very sober subject. There are, unfortunately, a certain number of individuals out there who are our enemies and will not change and are bent on our destruction, and we're going to have to find them, and one way or the other, we're going to have to either, they're either going to have to be killed or captured, to be blunt. I think we ought to, even in that context, we ought to avoid the use of conventional military force to the maximum extent we can, because that has a tendency to just outrage, and for very obvious reasons, create more hostility just by virtue of the beyond that, I think all what you need are all the rest of the tools that the U.S. government can bring to bear. I mean, you have to recognize that when you have large numbers of unemployed males in societies who perceive that the United States is marginalizing their societies, where they've got no future, where they're generally angry and disenfranchised, I'm playing kind of fast and loose with terms here, but that you've got to use the term, some root causes there that you better address, or you're going to be playing this game of just trying to tread water and keep up with the phenomenon for a long time.
So let me ask Phyllis Bennett, I'm going to ask Frank Gaffney, and then we talk about root causes here and how to approach this. I mean, and just trying to weigh some of the things that Sam Faddis has said, Phyllis, and I know you'll jump right back at me if I do this. I don't want to simplify your argument to you have to just get out now from Afghanistan and not drop drones in Pakistan. But there is an issue beyond that that is pretty deep, that we have
Absolutely.
Stumbled ourselves and gotten ourselves into a war with Pashtun people in two countries. And the blowback is very serious. So you've got to address that somehow with more than just bringing our troops home, don't we?
Absolutely. That's what I said. I said that you can't just, quote, cut and run, that we need engagement, that we need an entirely different kind of engagement. You know, it's interesting that our military leaders as well as political leaders have been saying for over a year now that the balance of resources, whether it's people, whether it's money, especially money, should be at the level of 80-20. 80% should be for non-military. It should be for humanitarian assistance. It should be for development. It should be for diplomacy. And only 20% should be for the military. Well, if we look at the reality, now, left to me, I would say even less than that for the military. But okay, that's not a bad start. The reality is the real spending is something like 93-7 in the opposite direction. 93% of the spending in Afghanistan right now is for the military, and only about 7% is in the is non-military. Then, if you look at people, just with the so-called civilian surge, which is, and I say so-called quite deliberately, we're now up to close to 1,000 civilians working for the government in Afghanistan, and we're approaching 100,000. Troops, and another 105,000 private military contractors, better known as mercenaries. But, you know, I think this isn't just about the division of resources. That's a signal of what it is. But I think, I mean, first of all, I have to respond to one thing that Frank said, that he knows as well as everybody else, that the language of Sharia and the language of Islam does not define jihad as a military battle. It's defined in the Quran first as an internal battle of a person with their God. So it's not about governments. It's not about who controls. There's others in this country and elsewhere in the world who do believe that some people should either have to die or convert. Among them are the Christian Zionists, who are the absolute supporters of Israel, who believe that people like me, who are Jewish, will, by the time of the Second Coming, have to either convert or die. And that's why they support Israel. It's not a great level of support, I got to say. But I think the point that we raise here is very crucial, that we're not saying, certainly I'm not saying, that if we changed our policy and stopped killing Afghans, if we stopped sending drones into Pakistan, if we changed our policy on Israel-Palestine, that's not going to change the mind of Osama bin Laden's leaders. It's not going and his deputies. It's not going to change the minds of Al Qaeda and its 100 or so people in Afghanistan and its 300 or so people in Pakistan. What it will do, I think, is change the minds over time of the huge numbers of people around the world who have begun to think that these horrifying people in organizations like Al Qaeda, maybe it's not such a bad idea what they think. Maybe they have the right idea because they are so angry. Those are the people that we need to reach and that we can and must reach with real policy differences than what we've had for the last number of years.
So
I'm going to have to go here. If I could get a response to that, I'd like to, and then I'm going to have to run off. Look, I don't know what familiarity Phyllis has with Sharia, but it bespeaks a lack of understanding of what it actually requires. When in the principle of abrogation, which says the last is what governs, and the last, chronologically, the last section of the Quran, which talks about jihad, makes it absolutely clear this is war. This is about forcing, wherever necessary, submission of your enemies, Christians, Jews, and other infidels, and for that matter, other Muslims who are not with the program, to conform to Sharia. This is the practice, and to continue to harp on the idea that this is Al-Qaeda that we're up against is, again, to completely misunderstand the phenomenon. It's like saying that the reason that these guys hate us is because they're poor. Well, with very few exceptions, all of the people who have been engaged in these attacks are not poor. There are people who have, in many cases, advanced degrees. There are people who have, in quite a number of cases, benefited from living in the West. Their hatred is not, I submit to you, simply a product of alienation or, difficult social circumstances. This is about conforming to a theocratic program, a program that is at its core a political program, not a faith, a political totalitarian program. And what they're doing is simply out what they believe has been directed by, Allah. So at the end of the day, what I'm convinced we're missing now most is a connecting of the dots, a coherent understanding of what animates our enemy, and a refusal in the name of political correctness or submission, I'm afraid, to challenge this reality on the grounds that we should, and that it should be, if you have a lick of sense, you see it's presenting itself as having, then, we condemn ourselves to continued failure. We're not going to succeed in Afghanistan. We're not going to succeed in Iraq. And ultimately, we're not going to succeed here. But I would just say, lastly, Phyllis's suggestion that the takeaway for the world of possible future adherence to Sharia, giving in to Al-Qaeda and its friends, is not that we will deny them the recruiting tool, as we're often told. It will be the absolute vindication of what Al-Qaeda is saying. Just as Hamas is forcing the Israelis out of Gaza was a vindication of their strategy, and Hezbollah forcing the Israelis out of South Lebanon did the same. It emboldens people. It does not suggest to them that they're on the wrong side by lining up with the people on the strong horse. So with that, I've got to go, and I thank you very much for letting me join you.
Thanks, Frank. Right.
Well, I wish I had a chance to talk a bit more with Frank Gaffney about those ideas. But I wonder, if when you look at what we're facing on the front page of the New York Times on Sunday with Anwar Awalaki, the Yemeni American imam who we've now decided that we are going to assassinate, and where that kind of policy takes us. And I was reading that last. I read the whole thing, and I thought about it a great deal. I talked to some other people over the weekend who, one I wish we had on the show today but couldn't come, who actually knew him in a Muslim center in D.C., and we'll have him on shortly. But to watch people get angry and turn for lots of reasons is something that's very real. Another friend of mine who's very close to the Somali community here, whose wife is Somali, who lives in America, said that the numbers of young people in the Somali community who are frustrated and angry and alienated is a minority, but not an insignificant number of young people who want to take on the West and who live here already. I mean, these are very real issues that we have to face. And the question is, how do we do that without arresting masses of people and creating some kind of situation that will, again, not just be undemocratic, but also violate human rights, but also kind of blow back on us again in a very negative way. I mean, these are very serious things that America's facing. We've gotten, in some ways, may have created it on our own, but we clearly are facing this. But I'm being told I have to take a break. When we come back, I really want to hear Sam and Phyllis pick up on this one with my co-host, Anthony McCarthy. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Welcome back. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, you can go to www.umm.edu/heart. We are joined here by Sam Faddis, Charles Faddis in his book title, but Sam Faddis as he's known, former CIA operations officer, author of Willful Neglect, The Dangerous Illusion of Homeland Security, Phyllis Bennis, author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. The number here is 410-319-8888 before we get to the calls coming in. So I'm curious as to how, when you think about our forest policy, what we talked about earlier, what's going on, how you begin to address the very real issue of what we're facing here in America. I mean, you were right, Phyllis, when you said earlier it was a bungled operation. But let's say it wasn't a completely bungled operation, and the bomb wasn't exactly the way what really good bomb makers would have done in terms of creating something that would have had a huge explosion. But you'd have had 10, 15 people killed, dozens wounded, disruption in Times Square. People would have been in a panic. America would have been in a panic. So whether it was a bungled Pakistani Taliban attack or not, it still is very real.
That's very real, and you've just described exactly what the people of places like Marja face on a daily basis.
You mean in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan.
Right.
People all around the world face problems of terrorism, problems of state terrorism, some of it ours. You know, the notion that we're now debating on the front page of the New York Times, should we assassinate this guy who
right.
is, quote, hiding in Yemen? Last I heard, he was living in Yemen. I don't know if he's hiding or not. If he's hiding, he's not doing a very good job. Everybody seems to know right where he is. And the debate is, should we kill him or not? Well, first of all, whatever happened to the 1976 U.S. prohibition against government assassinations? There was no exception. If it's somebody we really don't like, somebody who's, like, saying bad things, even somebody who's training people to come after us, there were no exceptions. We don't assassinate, except apparently we do. Then there's the matter of international law. You know, this is why the U.S. was so worried, I think, about not wanting to join the International Criminal Court, because we carry out criminal acts in violation of international law. And that means that our top officials, military and civilians, would be vulnerable to being brought up on charges in The Hague, as they should if they carry out these kinds of acts. So, you know, yes, it would be a horrific thing if a bomb went off, whether it was in Times Square, whether it was Oklahoma City, wherever it was. It's horrific. There is no explanation, justification that makes it okay. The question is, how do you stop it? And I would say that debating the killing of the imam currently in Yemen is precisely not the way you stop it. That's the way you breed more either terrorism or support for terrorism. The first thing you do if you want to win hearts and minds in Afghanistan is stop killing Afghans. If you want to win hearts and minds in Pakistan, the first thing you do is stop killing Pakistanis. Apologizing for it isn't going to do it. You know, General McChrystal can get up every other night and say, oh, we're so sorry, we're trying to do better, we're trying to kill fewer civilians. That doesn't do it. That doesn't cut it. As long as you're killing people, people are going to hate you. That comes with the territory.
Sam?
Well, let's see. I'll agree. You know, look, as I said before, I think what you're talking about here is an incredibly complex subject and ends up being like kind of a three-dimensional game of chess. And I'm all for absolutely minimizing the military and intelligence angles of this, and I'm certainly for minimizing occupations of foreign countries by conventional forces, which bankrupt us, get our people killed, and in the process antagonize whole populations. But at the end of the day, there are guys who are actively involved in operations against us. This guy in Yemen is one of them. And, you know, we get into a game of, we get into a question of semantics as to what constitutes assassination. And I don't have the magic answer on that. I think when you're a member of Al-Qaeda and you're actively organizing plots on our, you know, against our citizens and on our soil, then you've made yourself an enemy combatant, and this is really, you've put yourself in the game. So I don't see the legal issue. Back to my central thesis, anybody who thinks that this is some gigantic game of whack-a-mole, and I don't mean that to trivialize it, where there's just X number of guys out there and we just track them down and get rid of them is really missing the much, much broader picture. It's a lot more complex than that. And the other thing I would throw in here at this point, just because I think it's worth remembering, and we're all focused on radicalization of Muslims and talking about Muslims on our soil. I've run a lot of counterterrorism operations, and in many, many cases, obviously working with the locals. And given the nature of my business, usually that means that's a handful of Americans and the bulk of the guys who are on our side, to be simplistic about it, were always Muslims. So, in other words, most of the guys that are out there dying, fighting on the same side as we are in this conflict, are not American. I mean, for every American that gets killed here, there are many more Turks or Pakistanis or Afghans who are wearing security force uniforms, army uniform, police uniforms. They are dying in much larger numbers trying to stop this.
So let's step back for a minute. What you just said, Sam, and Phyllis, I'd like you to pick up on this, and we will open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Michael, you're the first caller up. When we talk about sides in this conflict, Phyllis, and we know that we know that there are organized groups around the world, whether they are Christian Zionists who would like, don't care whether you're Jewish or not, just get out of the way so we can have the Holy Land back and the Second Coming come, or whether it's Al-Qaeda. But in this case, Al-Qaeda, it's very real. So what I hear Sam Faddis saying is that's a war at whatever level, counterterrorism, intelligence, that has to be waged because people are actively involved in wanting to hurt people in the United States of America and to do battle with any forces that are forces of enlightenment in their own countries, whether it's Pakistan.
I don't think it's a war, and I don't think we can claim to be the forces of enlightenment.
No, I didn't say we were. I said they want to fight the forces of enlightenment in their own countries.
I don't think there are any forces of enlightenment at the moment in those countries. I certainly don't think we are them. But I think the bottom line is, I don't think it's a war. I think that if we look at those people that we have caught and interrogated and gotten information about, they've been caught through good police work. We need good police work. We need international collaboration among police forces. We need good intelligence. We're not going to get it this way. People have every reason to lie to us. They'll lie to stop torture when we torture them, which we do. They'll lie if they think that they can sell out somebody else and get some money, which often happens. I mean, this is not, it's simply not a war. It was declared to be a war in the White House. And once you declare a war, then you say, well, then you have rights. Then you can go and kill people. Well, declaring something a war, in my view, doesn't make it a war. You know, the U.S. Congress could declare something a war. We should note they never did. But even a declaration by Congress of a war that is in violation of international law, which this one is in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in Iraq, not one of them match the criteria of the U.N. Charter and its criteria for what makes a war legal. So in that situation, it's simply specious to say, well, it's a war, and therefore we get to go and kill people. Yes, there are people who want to do us harm, us in the West, us in the United States, various views of various ones. There are people who want to do us harm. We want to do an awful lot of people harm, it seems, and we're doing it. I don't think that it makes it a war. These are crimes. What happened on 9/11 was a huge crime against humanity, a huge crime. It was not a war. It was carried out by people who didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't go to school. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. They were inspired by someone who was getting protection in Afghanistan. So we get to go to war against a whole country because of that? I don't think so. I don't think so. So this notion that because we were attacked for the first time in a generation in that horrific day of September 11, that somehow we get to go to war against anybody we want for as long as we want in any country in the world with no restrictions, but no other country can do that. No other country has the right to go to war against us for something that we did in their country. No, we just have to apologize, and then they're supposed to say, oh, if you apologize, then it's okay. Then it's then we'll like you. I mean, this just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm over the phones here, but I mean, the one thing you said earlier, though, Phyllis, that I would challenge is saying there were no forces of enlightenment in countries like Afghanistan or Pakistan. There are lots. I mean,
there are plenty of people who are. I'm saying among the military forces. I meant among the military side. There are plenty of enlightened people in both of those countries.
And a lot of them have fled. I mean, the great cultural leaders and intellects of Kabul and Baghdad are living here.
And many have gone back, and they're trying. They're not necessarily all succeeding, but there are plenty of people there who are enlightened, people who never left. They didn't all leave.
No, they didn't all leave. But let me open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, folks. I think it's a question of lenses, right? And we can parse it through a legal lens, or we can parse it through an intelligence or a realpolitik, geopolitical lens. But ultimately, the ultimate lens is that matters is equity, because equity matters. You asked the question, Mark, before the formal last break, and you know the reason people are doing the things that they're doing both abroad and here is because of disenfranchisement and equity. And it's not that everyone's going to ever be equal, but it's the key word that Phyllis just said, trying. It's the attempt to try to perfect a more perfect union. And when you stop genuinely trying in any society, including our own, that's when you run into problems and you run into this kind of rage that or malaise that those who would direct their rage at us can tap into. And I think that whether it's international terrorism or Tea Party, it's really the issue becomes, and I think we have to really look at that lens. And then if that is the primary lens, then how we execute either our legal strategies or our intelligence or military strategies. And indeed, I think that's what the military leaders were getting at when they redid the Army Field Manual. I mean, that because they realized that's what wins hearts and minds. And so I think the conversation of equity needs to inform whatever analysis or lens that we tend to look at.
Well, how do we – let's respond to Michael, and I'll start with the Phyllis and then go to Sam. How do we create that equity in our policies and how we approach the world?
I think one way to think about it, it's not a policy guide, but one way to think about this is what would we do, how would we feel if some other country faced the exact same problems that we did? We have an example, actually. Look at Cuba. In 1976, there was an attack on a Cuban airliner, a terrorist attack that brought down the airliner, killed 75, 78
right.
people on board. It was planned and carried out by people who were living in the U.S. under the protection of the U.S. government. Terrorists, in my view. Now, did that give Cuba the right to come and attack Washington militarily? I don't think so. Luckily, the Cubans recognized that. They didn't do it. They didn't do it. So, we need to look, when we talk about equity, I think it's the right approach. We need to look at what gives us the right to think that because somebody once attacked us, massively, yes, that we somehow have the right to declare war on the whole world. How many times have people from this country done devastating things in other countries? Does that give those countries the right to declare war on the whole world and expect the United Nations to support it and the powerful nations of the world to support it? No, it doesn't. It's because we have this understanding of American exceptionalism that makes us think that we have the right to do that. We were attacked, and somehow that's different than the kinds of attacks on civilians that occur every day in this world. You know, when Britain was attacked in the buses, when Spain was attacked in the metro systems, they didn't declare war on the whole world. They responded, in fact, the Spanish responded by pulling their troops out of Iraq, recognizing that that wasn't helping. So I think that we need to look, I think equity is a very good starting place. What right do we have more rights, to claim more rights than we allow anybody else to have?
Sam, do you want to comment on this before we go to the next caller?
I think what we need in general is a significantly more nuanced policy. I mean, I certainly agree that many of the actions that were taken under the previous administration that we're still stuck with at this point were sort of the equivalent of using a sledgehammer, you know, when a scalpel would have been a much better instrument.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Troy in your car. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the terms. Yeah, there's a lot of, I guess we're commenting on the term war versus policing, and I actually agree with the woman that's on the air right now that's commenting on the policing aspect of it. But I think what we should also recognize in a country that's in turmoil constantly, like Afghanistan, they don't have the ability to police them themselves. So if they come to this country and commit acts of terrorists, which, I mean, you say that it happens all the time, but I don't know any other acts of terrorists that have taken down 3,000 people in a day. To go over there and help police themselves, you know, is one thing. Now, to declare war on them is completely different. I'm a United States Marine. I've spent time in the military, obviously. I'm not quite sure why we have to have troops on the ground, and certainly why we can't just react with strategic airstrikes and whatnot. And I think that will send the message, because I believe that's what we're trying to send the message. In return, for Spain to withdraw once they've been attacked is completely sending the entire wrong message. But either way, I just wanted to make a comment on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Troy.
I would just wonder, though, I'm sorry he hung up, but what does he think about the fact that these were not Afghans who attacked us on September 11th? They came from Egypt and they came from Saudi Arabia, our two closest allies. So why aren't we, if he wants to talk about airstrikes, why aren't we attacking Cairo? Why aren't we attacking Mecca? You know, I mean, it doesn't make sense saying that because they came to us that we can attack any other country we choose, somewhere they were inspired from. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Charlene, you're on the air.
Well, good evening.
Good evening, Charlene.
Hi, Charlene.
You know, hi there, Anthony. You know, I listen to your show regularly, and I had to stop my car and call because I am so encouraged to hear the comments of Phyllis Bettis. And I missed the beginning of the show, and I kept hearing you sing Phyllis, and I said, well, who is Phyllis? You know, because I am quite honest. I mean, frankly, I am just so sick and tired of all of the wars that are going on right now and the loss of life. And this was the only voice I had to call and just say, you know, this is a voice of reason. We need to start using common sense. Start thinking about it, not in anyone's interest, militarily or financial. It comes down to money or whatever. But we have to change our way of thinking, our whole perspective on war and justifying it. As far as I'm concerned, we're in the 21st century, and we cannot come up with any other way to resolve our differences or conflict. So I had to call. I really want to know more about Phyllis Bettis and her books, and I want to know, what can we do to really begin to spread this message? That is unlike the message that we hear on a daily basis.
Well, thank you, Charlene.
Ordinary citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, let me so we can get a couple of callers in and let Phyllis and Sam respond. Phyllis, why don't you respond a bit to the Charlene?
Well, thank you first, Charlene. I really appreciate what you said. My colleague David Wildman, who's traveled extensively in Afghanistan, he and I wrote this book called Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer, which is designed to be exactly that. It's to help people figure out, what do we do to end this war? And a lot of it has to recognize that we're in a very different political moment than we were during the Bush years, when people were as much against the war in Iraq as they were against Bush for a whole bunch of other reasons. Right now, we don't have somebody in the White House who people see as, quote, the enemy. Well, I guess some people do, but not the people who are trying to end these wars. But the wars have continued, and I think that what the new polls are telling us, the new poll from just a few days ago indicated that now 52% of Americans say the war was not worth fighting and should be ended. And what the challenge before us is to turn that into a change in policy. So it means that for politicians who never lead, they never lead. They move, they change, kicking and screaming when they have no other choice. We have to make it so costly in political terms for politicians in Congress, in the administration, to continue this war, that they decide they have to end it because there is no other option. That's our job. So that means everything from the usual stuff, writing letters to Congress, writing letters to the editor, writing op-eds, calling radio talk shows, as you're doing now. All of these things are crucial. There are teach-ins going on around around the country. The crucial thing that's different now is the cost of this war. You know, the escalation that President Obama promised us of 30,000 new troops, that's costing $33 billion. That number is so high, I can't even really comprehend it. But what I do know is that that same $33 billion could be used to provide 660,000 new green jobs back here in the U.S. You do the math. What's going to make us safer? Is it going to be to send 30,000 new young troops to kill and die in Afghanistan? Or should we keep that money at home? We have to start asking, where's our money? One soldier in Afghanistan now cost $1 million for the year. That $1 million, you could hire that soldier and 19 more young people like her or like him for that same $1 million. Good jobs, green jobs, to transform our economy. That's what we need to be talking about.
So, Sam, I'm curious, again, you've kind of alluded to and talked about where you think that the mistakes and vagaries of this policy have been in the last administration. And you've lived through a number of administrations and done a great deal of work from your books, we can see. So I'm curious, when you say that the military should be the least of what we do, then from your perspective as an intelligence officer, what should be the focus? How do you address the issues that you've had to face in the years you served?
Well, I think there's an element here, unfortunately, there are a whole bunch of dimensions to this. Well, one of them, frankly, is as simple as, you know, we have a military and it's really good at doing what it's doing, and that gives us the illusion sometimes of feeling like we're dealing with a problem. I'm 100% in support of the idea that we need to be finding a way to extract ourselves from Afghanistan and get out of this conflict. I mean, we don't have the money. As you are well aware, my son is a U.S. Marine and has already done one tour there. He's going back in a few months. We are paying in blood and treasure for this. We don't have either. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that it's really making the United States safer. I mean, after all, by this point, Al-Qaeda has hardly any presence in Afghanistan. I think what we need to be doing, when there are those portions of networks and individuals that are working against this country, and unfortunately, I believe, know that there are, then we need to be a lot more sophisticated and a lot more subtle about finding ways to get rid of them. And every time we've got a country where there's an existing law enforcement system that is effective enough to tackle the problem, then obviously we ought to do that. Nobody's talking about putting people on the ground in the United Kingdom to deal with this.
Sam
Faddis, still some places where we're going to have to go and do it ourselves, unfortunately.
Sam Faddis, thank you so much for joining us once again. Phyllis Bennis, it's always a pleasure to hear your thoughts and voice on the show.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Take care.
And Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back. I want to remind you on the way to this break, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. When we return, we'll talk about the Tea Party phenomenon, political what it means, how much does race play into it. and just what historical roots are of that movement and what you think about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.